I repeat myself. How's my level looking?
That's just fine.
My level's looking fine. Yeah. Then turn my volume up a little bit. A little more. Yeah, right there. Okay. All right. For those listening to KSBN Money Talk Radio who might be interested in buying physical precious metals for less than what I can pay for them, stay tuned. I have a way you can support this show and secure what I believe is the best price for precious metals on the existing market. In our first commercial break, I will explain this in more detail. And now, let's get on with Reclaiming the Republic. Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This is G.R. Mobley. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. If you go to ReclaimingTheRepublic.org, you can download our podcast and support documents and links. This is an educational, grassroots program designed to restore the Republic and placing the general government, or what many refer to as the federal government, back into the constitutional framework and scope of the Constitution. Well, there's no point in calling in today because we actually have a special guest. I've got Bob Zadek that will be our guest this afternoon, and I think you're going to enjoy this conversation. He just recently published a book, Secret Sauce, The Anti-Federalists May Have Been Right, and we will get into all of that when we hit the second segment when we come back. But before we do, again, this is an educational show, and so many of these references that I make in this show and in other shows refer to previous shows like Platonist. And so you have to stay abreast by listening to the podcast so that you can understand and garner what I am talking about and why we need to become far more proactive and taking back our Constitution. And so don't forget, you can download these podcasts at ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. Councilman Ed Pace will be hosting his last town hall events this week. And so this Friday at Fours of Coffee on Sullivan and 4th, and this Saturday at Rosar's on University and Sprague. So if you want to catch him before the election is finalized, then these are the last two events. And so Republican Coffee Club this Friday will be hosting the return of David Bolognese, part two of the Avista Becoming Power One and other topics, excuse me. And November 10th, on the Marine Corps birthday, Dave Moore will be speaking of the Wonder Waffe of World War II, basically the super weapons that were developed. So these are very interesting meetings. And the details of the location of this, time and all of that, 7 a.m., you can get at the Republic, ReclaimingTheRepublic.org website as well on the links page. And so as I've been saying for at least the past 6, if not 9 months, that this is a very special election and very important one. And for this election, for those who have not voted yet, I just want you to know that I'm endorsing for City Spokane, or the Spokane City Council, Tim Benn, Andy Dunow, and Matthew Howes. And I'm endorsing for the Spokane Valley City Council, Rod Higgins, Caleb Collier, Ed Pace, Pamela Haley, and Mike Munch. And there's reasons why I am supporting these, because they're the most constitutional and they are the ones that you can count on in protecting your private property and those things that are your inalienable rights, your constitutional rights. The candidates that I'm not endorsing, almost all of them have resorted to dirty tactics, digging up dirt to expose their opponents, because on the issues, they are being crushed by these constitutional candidates. So the following candidates that have had hit pieces written about their written by them or by their supporters about their opponents, and that would be Kate Burke, who has written and had or hit pieces and bad propaganda put out about Tim Benn. Candace Mum did a deplorable piece on Matthew Howes, and they're backpedaling, and so I think that's kind of backfired on them. Hopefully it backfires enough to ensure that that progressive doesn't get that seat. Caleb Collier also had a hit piece by Candy Petz and by her supporters, and or whether you want to call her supporters the Progressive Spokesman Review. But anyway, if you read the latest article that they posted, it wasn't it had nothing to do with the facts, and they were basically taking things out of context to try to shine a bad light on Caleb, and just shame on them. But that's what progressives will do. Ed Pace, the same thing with WIC and the WIC supporters, and the fact that there are people that are, you know, turning their heads to the fact that the SEIU labor has endorsed Ben WIC is just repugnant to me, that other people are, you know, turning their heads in supporting WIC. And Linda Thompson supporters did the same thing on a hit piece with Mike Munch. And so why is it that these progressives keep on doing that? If you compare and contrast the differences in campaigning just between these good conservative people and their progressives, the progressives try to obfuscate exactly what the issues are. They are using tactics to try to personally assassinate or assault and attack their opponents instead of really trying to come to the issue. And every single one of these issues is moot. I mean, it has no bearing on their ability to serve as a public servant and being your representative. And so those who I am backing and endorsing, again, are those who would be your best representative, ensuring and protecting your private property, your rights, and so forth. Ed Pace, and his opponent Ben WIC could have had and availed himself as far as coming onto this show. So let me give you a perspective, because I actually had three candidates come onto this show. So back again, Ed Pace and his opponent Ben WIC could have been on the show together, but Ben WIC was supposedly unavailable. And actually, I sent emails to him saying, "Hey, well, maybe I can have you on for this particular show, November 1st, because I was booked up last week with Caleb and his supposed opponent." But there was no interest, no reply, or what have you back from him. So, you know, I can only presume that he really doesn't want to talk about the Constitution and why it's important to the position he's running for, because he doesn't want to be held accountable to those types of standards. And I think that's the same thing with Caleb and Brandi Pitts. Caleb definitely is a guy that you can hold accountable as a representative and a supporter of the Constitution, where Brandi can't speak to it, doesn't want to. And as a matter of fact, once they get in office, these progressives want to do whatever's best in serving those who put them there. And that's what you can see. This happens from the local level all the way up to the national level. They become the servants, or like I always used to use this metaphor, they're the monkeys on the string dancing for the organ grinder. And that organ grinder is the people that are paying and supporting them to get them in that seat, not necessarily the people. And so the exact same thing happened with Tim Benn and his opponent when I tried to get them on. Kate Burke passed instead of coming onto the show and speaking to the importance. And I just don't think that Kate Burke, Brandi Pitts, and Ben WIC considers the Constitution of any importance for you. In my opinion, these opponents that did not come onto this show, again, even went further in obfuscating, because they had the opportunity to come up and say, you know, "I stand firm on protecting your property rights. I stand firm on the Constitution and understanding the meddling forces of the federal government," and as we've talked about with these different candidates. So this is not a trifling matter. I hope that if you have not voted, that you will highly consider the candidates that I'm endorsing. And I'll say them again: Tim Benn, Andy Donow, Matthew Howes for Spokane City Council, and for the Spokane Valley City Council, Rod Higgins, Caleb Collier, Ed Pace, Pamela Haley, and Mike Munch. So that being said, last week I also mentioned the disgraceful Senator McCain. I just cannot fathom why people keep putting him in office. His legislation, the things he sponsored and voted for, has been abysmal. He is not a supporter of individual liberty and your property rights and so forth. I mean, he supports U.S. citizens being detained indefinitely by the military and or other enforcement agencies. And to me, this kind of supports the fact of the the importance of what I talked about in my first book on 2013 and how we have to start having constitutional tests for our candidates. Bottom line, if we don't have a standard for our candidates, then they can dance all over us, and they will. Well, that's the end of this segment, and we're going to have Bob Zedek as soon as we come back from this break. So please stay tuned, and we will be right back after a word from our sponsors. Thank you. Okay, folks, we are back, and we have Bob Zedek on the phone with us. And Bob, I believe you're sitting on the water in San Francisco, in the bay?
I am in Richardson Bay in Sausalito, on board the boat, which is my home, and the boat is named Laissez-Faire, and that's not a coincidence. And it's not because I'm French, because I'm not French. I grew up in Queens, New York.
There we go. I think I've garnered a little bit of an accent there anyway. Yes, it sounded like a New York Eastern Seaboard accent. As far as the books go, I know you've written a book. It's The Secret Sauce, The Anti-Federalists Were Right, or something like that. But did you write a book before this, or is this your first venture into publishing?
This is my first book. I've published articles, and I'm a lawyer, and I've written a lot in legal journals, which is of modest to no interest to your audience or my audience, but this is the first book on the important part of my life, which is libertarian issues and constitutional studies.
Okay, and so the interesting thing, folks, is that Bob's book is really not a book that he just sat down and hammered out. But he did kind of sit down and hammer this out, because if I understand your process, Bob, what you do is you come up with the conversation and some general dialogue to have with your guests, and then you would really work it through its volition within your hour segment or what have you, and that basically was the genesis of this book.
Well, the genesis of this book was... I've been doing my radio show for about 9 years, okay. And almost always I have a guest, and 100% of the time, the guests I have are smarter than me, and they have collectively all of the wisdom that exists on Earth, and I did the show, and I shared my guest wisdom with the audience, but what they said, I realized, was so important, I wanted it preserved. So we went through the actual transcript of maybe 400 shows and picked out, although it was almost impossible, the best of the best. And we picked out the interviews that I enjoyed doing the most and that had content that was not time sensitive, that was for the ages. And we were able to take portions of actual interviews, transcripts, and weave them into a narrative that was consistent, informative, and not sensitive to time. So this book would be of interest 100 years from now as much as it is right now. And that became the book. So the book is the selective, not titled, but is in fact the collective, and I had picked out and selected wisdom of my guests over the past 9 years. And the guests are really smart people. They are authors, scholars, commentators, professors, historians. They have so much knowledge. I wanted to find a way to preserve it in written form, and that's what I have done.
Okay. And basically, I think the title does say, and it kind of goes to... I want to say the heart of your feelings, that the anti-federalists were correct when they started looking and examining the Constitution, that there were these holes that weren't necessarily addressed, and or they recognized and pointed to certain problems. And so I'll let you elaborate, because I believe that's something that you really feel passionate about.
Well, it was a very, very interesting intellectual journey. I started off, let's say, a decade ago, committed to our Constitution, to the principles of the Constitution, to the principles of the founding, to the wisdom of the founding generation of our country. And then I guess it all started for me when I read a fascinating book written by a historian who died about 4 years ago. She was a professor of American history at MIT. Her name is Pauline Maier, M-E-I-E-R. And she wrote a book called Ratification, which told a fascinating story. It told the story of the roughly 14 months from the moment in mid-September of 1787 that the Constitution was finished being drafted, from that moment to the moment that at least nine states had ratified it, which means there would be a country. And she tells the story of ratification and the battles in the state ratifying conventions. And as I read her wonderful narrative, I found myself rooting for the Anti-Federalists as if it were a suspense novel and I didn't know how it ended. I found myself hoping the Constitution doesn't get ratified. And I found myself realizing that the Anti-Federalists, Patrick Henry, Edmund Randolph, George Mason, and a bunch of others, that their predictions of what would happen to our country if the Constitution were ratified was far more accurate than the prediction of the Federalists who favored ratification. So here I was, rooting against a document that I spent most of my adult life defending and supporting and being in love with because of its wisdom. So it was a profound intellectual change for me, and that's one of the themes. There are many themes in the book we've written, The Secret Sauce, but that's one of the dominant themes. And you don't hear my words, you hear the words of historians and scholars and constitutional lawyers, and I didn't manipulate their language. It was so clear that the prediction of the Anti-Federalists was exactly right. And that resulted in my feelings right now that the Constitution is in many ways a flawed document. Its goals were good, but it was flawed, and it didn't carry out its goals. And it became weakened over time.
Well,
now maybe the weakness couldn't have been avoided, but it happened nevertheless.
Well, so I know 10 minutes fly by fast, and so we're pretty close to wrapping up the first 10 minutes. But let me kind of prep and kind of get you cogitating on this thought, because if the framers, because one of the biggest problems Mason had and a lot of them had was there was no Bill of Rights. And so they had this real reservation in ratifying. They said, well, you know, we don't want to do this. As a matter of fact, I believe Virginia actually had votes on saying we were going to ratify with stipulation. In other words, they weren't going to ratify it. They were basically going to say, give us the Bill of Rights first before we ratify this, so that we can, you know, scrutinize. Because what Patrick Henry wanted to do was he wanted to go into another convention. And so I look at all of the feedback, because reading the ratification debates and reading that exact same book and a lot of other really good history books like Madison's Pursuit of the Bill of Rights, it gave me the insight. If there was one thing that they really failed to do, and Hamilton and Madison kind of talked to this, and I believe that it was brought up, not necessarily in your face in the ratification debates, but it was definitely brought up in your face in the Federalist Papers, because now these guys had time to sit down and articulate their articles, where they didn't have that time when they got up to, you know, to either retort or to provide information. It was far more dynamic during the ratification debates. But
if there was one thing, and here's the question I have for you, so that when we go into break, you can think about this. What's the one thing that they should have ensured or should have told the states, you really need to do this one thing to make this a better symbiotic relationship? And so, folks, stay tuned. We'll be right back with Bob Zadek after these words from our sponsors. So stay tuned. Okay, so we are back, and I still have Bob Zadek on the line, and he's still floating out there in the gullies of the Pacific. And so, Bob, I wanted to pose this question to you. Is there one thing that the states or should have done, you know, the federal government, was there one thing that they should have done that would have, you know, kind of contained the encroachments and the perpetual creep that the federal government has done?
Well, the story of the Bill of Rights is a fascinating story, and as an aside, I commend your listeners to a wonderful book written by an historian named, her name is Carol Barkin, B-A-R-K-I-N. She recently wrote a book, recently in the past couple of years. She is now working in New York. I think she's at Hunter College. She grew up in the South. She is a well-published and has been on many interview shows, Carol Barkin, and she writes an entire book on the story of the Bill of Rights, which is fascinating. And Carol was a guest on my show. And I learned from her, as I learned from every guest, I learned that the Bill of Rights itself has a fascinating story. And just to summarize it, Madison opposed the concept of a Bill of Rights. The Bill of Rights presumably lists certain rights that citizens are entitled to and are protected from the government interfering with. Freedom of association, freedom to practice their religion, freedom of speech, freedom of press, etc. And certain rights where we're protected from action by the government, like searches and seizures and cruel and inhuman punishment, cruel or unusual punishment. But the reason Madison and others opposed the Bill of Rights is they said, hold it, guys. You don't need a Bill of Rights because we have created a federal government of very, very limited powers. That seems almost comical today, but in Madison's view, or at least his public view, the federal government had limited powers. And Madison and others said at the time, you don't need protection against encroachment on the practice of religion because nothing in this 4,400-word document called the Constitution, nothing gives the government the power to interfere with freedom of religion. Therefore, since the government can only do what it is empowered to do, and the government has no power to mess with your freedom to practice religion, you don't need a Bill of Rights. Well, nobody, a huge segment of the population said, yeah, right. We want it anyway. So the states were told, and this is part of what you learn when you study the ratification. The states were told, look, we're running out of time. We won the war against England, but we're not out of the woods yet. We better form a country really fast so we can get organized here and get our army organized. And therefore, the ratification process is up or down. Do you like this Constitution or not? But do not change it. We haven't got the time. So it was like up or down, and we don't want to hear about your comments. Well, some states said, not so fast. We want the Bill of Rights. So since they couldn't change the document, there was an understanding that the ratification itself by Virginia and New York was unconditional, but there was an understanding that the Bill of Rights would be added soon after the country was formed. So now the country is formed without the Bill of Rights, without the amendments, and Madison is the Speaker of the House in the first House of Representatives. And Madison is a very wise politician and says, you know what? This country is like a couple of days old, and it's very fragile. And these anti-federalists are not really done fighting yet. So they're going to be complaining about no Bill of Rights. We have to take the wind out of their sails. So let's give them their gosh-darn Bill of Rights, because it doesn't hurt us anyway. So let's give them the Bill of Rights, and we've taken the wind out of their sails to attack the Constitution. And with that political calculation, Madison had his Congress do the Bill of Rights. The Bill of Rights started with about, in the 20s or in the 30s, in terms of individual rights. It got whittled down to 12 and then whittled down to 10. Part of it was just pure drafting. There was a consolidation and a cleaning up process. But that's, in a nutshell, the story of how we got the Bill of Rights. And Madison, before we leave the topic of the Bill of Rights, there's one interesting observation that I made, I think, on a show at one time, and that was this. The founder said, you don't need a Bill of Rights. You already have it in the Constitution, so what are you worried about? But every single time there is a freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom of the press, litigation, and there still is plenty of it. Whenever there is litigation, the arguments in favor of freedom of speech or freedom of religion or free press or Fourth Amendment, they always cite to the amendments. They don't cite to the Constitution, which means all of the freedoms that are protected over time by the Supreme Court are protected because of the Bill of Rights, not because of the Constitution. So the anti-federalists who demanded a Bill of Rights were 100% right. Of course, no one cites the Constitution in defense of freedom of speech. They always cite the Bill of Rights, which says the Bill of Rights is almost more important than the Constitution itself.
Yes, and I know Madison actually stated when he was compiling the Bill of Rights and doing all the research, because he actually did a lot of research before that first congressional session began, and he pulled in, because he was already corresponding with all the different states at the time, he requested a copy of their Bill of Rights, as well as assembling all of the amendment recommendations that came in from the states. And I believe Massachusetts was the first that set that precedence. New York, Virginia, and even some of the Carolinas piled in what they wanted to, you know, see as far as amendments and the Bill of Rights and so forth to be included in this amendment process. But one of the things, I'm just going to throw this in real as an aside, when Madison announced that he would be providing a Bill of Rights, I think it was going to be on later in June, and I want to say this was like June 8th when he announced this. The day after he announced that, I believe it was either New York or Virginia. I think it was Virginia was the first one to basically apply for an Article 5 convention. And then the following day, New York applied for an Article 5 convention. So Congress was already, it gave Madison, I think, a lot of wind in his sails to say, look, you know, more states will apply if we do not move on this. And we have to basically quill the rest of this contention regarding these Bill of Rights. So it was, I think, a motivating factor, if not a part of the essence of self-preservation as a politician, if you understand.
Your history is exactly right. You hit it right on. That's exactly what happened. Madison felt the country was too fragile in its first moments, and to get rid of all of these grumblings, he said, let's do the Bill of Rights. It doesn't change anything, because the government had no power to do this stuff anyway. So we're not giving them anything, in them being the anti-federalists, and we're just taking the argument away from them, and all of those grumblings about a convention will just die stillborn.
Okay.
And that's what happened.
Okay, so we know that the Bill of Rights was something that was done, but I still believe that there was one thing that they never did, and So the question still lies. We got less than a minute left of this 10-minute segment. So when we come back from the next break, if you will hold on with us again, Bob, and give me another 10 minutes of your time, I still would like to see if there was one thing, because I have something, but I'm not trying to put words in your mouth. Was there something else that had to happen to truly create, I think, a better balance? Because that's one of the things we always hear when we talk about the balances, and I think people have lost sight that Madison referred to separations of powers not just in a horizontal essence, but in a vertical essence as well. In other words, horizontal between the branches, but a vertical between the people and the states and the federal government as well, as far as separations of power. So folks, stay tuned. We will be right back with Bob Zadik, and we'll be back after this break. So please listen and support our sponsors, by the way, and we'll be right back. Thank you very much. Okay, so we are back, and we have Bob Zadik on the line with us. And the last segment, I kind of asked for what needed to occur, and Bob's absolutely right. We did need a Bill of Rights. The interesting thing is, and Madison kind of poked all the states in the eye regarding the Bill of Rights, was most of the states didn't have the Bill of Rights, such as the right to bear arms and some of these things that they wanted injected into this federal Bill of Rights. So he started pointing out the weaknesses of the states and their Bill of Rights, that they were protecting their people. But in the Federalist Papers, I know Hamilton actually said it verbatim. He said that the state legislatures would need to erect barriers so that they would have a mechanism so that when the federal government started encroaching, that they would have this built-in mechanism to say, no, you can't do this. And Madison alluded to it as well. I think it was Federalist Papers 46, where he kind of talked about, you know, the necessity, because the parchment barriers were not enough. And I think that's what he used, is that these barriers of parchment would not be enough, that it would be incumbent upon the states to create these barriers as well. So both of these brilliant men, and I think they were both brilliant. I liked one compared to the other, but do you not agree that the states really failed? The state legislatures just fought this, but they went into complacency once the Bill of Rights was handed them.
Well, the issue of allocation of power between the federal government and the states is one that is grossly misunderstood by Americans today, and for good cause. First of all, understand that Madison would, if he had his way, there would not be states. Hamilton had a bias against there being states. Madison, Washington, Hamilton were true nationalists. They had no use for the states and didn't see the states as serving very much of a purpose. Notwithstanding that, under the Articles of Confederation, our country, as it were, was something like Europe today, where you have separate countries in Europe bound by the European Union and a parliament sitting in Brussels. But all of the action is in these separate countries around Europe. Now, that was our country during the Articles of Confederation. That failed for lots of reasons. No ability to raise money, to raise taxes, you couldn't form an army, it was clunky. So that was what Madison and Washington and Hamilton were opposed to. They had not much use for the states. Madison would like to get rid of the states. But the states were there. The states were, from a governmental purpose, the center of gravity. The states did everything. They had what is called in political conversations the police power, which doesn't just mean cops. Police power is a very specific phrase that means they had the power and the responsibility to look after the health, welfare, and safety of the citizens. The federal government had no such power. It had no police power. The federal government and the enable the states to do collectively what they could not do so conveniently independently, like foreign policy, conducting war, defense, army, post office, interstate commerce, all the things that one state couldn't do by itself conveniently, the federal government was supposed to fill in the blanks. But everything else was at the state level. The Constitution, as drafted, had nothing to say about the power of the states. The states were free to interfere with freedom of religion, freedom of the press. There was no limitation on what a state can do. Now, most state constitutions had their own Bill of Rights. So those rights were protected. It was part of the fabric of the country at that time. But remember, the Constitution, until after the Civil War, with the 14th Amendment, had nothing to say about limiting the power of the states. So that state-federal relationship is grossly misunderstood. Now, we have an all-powerful, all-reaching leviathan of the federal government, which has responsibility for everything, and the states have become mere agencies of the federal government. New York is not a state, in my opinion. It is the New York Department of the federal government, and that's regretfully where we are today.
Well, I won't argue with that.
I kind of figured you would.
Yeah, so... but let me just say this, that per the Constitution, so there's this acting and exercising of power. And if you've seen the movie, The Lord of the Rings, this is what I like to use for the metaphor, that when the King of Rohan was under the spell of Wormtongue, his eyes were glazed over and he, you know, was basically believing that he was old, decrepit, and unable to do anything, that everything was lost. I mean, he was completely under this spell. And I believe that's the whole thing here with the states. The states are under this spell that they believe they have no power. And per the Constitution, there has not been really any changes within the Constitution, that the states still don't have the same powers. It's just that the federal government has created this leviathan and all these little teeny strings where they've kind of tied down all of these Gullivers, if you understand Gulliver's travel with a mixing of a metaphor here. And it's just a matter of just waking up with Gulliver and the King of Rohan. And, you know, Gandalf zapped him on the head and Gulliver just said, you know, I'm going to get up now, you know. And the states literally do have the power to step in and go, hold it. This is a contract. This contract is something that is very finite and defined. And if it's not enumerated or listed in this contract for you to be doing, then you don't have the power from us to do so. And so this is kind of a great segue into my Republic Review and my books and my premise of what I'm trying to move forward. And actually, I'm setting up a committee of correspondence here, but it's a constitutional committee of correspondence up here in Spokane, and this is kind of like where we're baking this, and hopefully this can start going out to all the different states and other good grassroots and, you know, well, call them the flyover states because that's what the progressives call them, but I believe it's the heartland that can save America. I believe it's those Gullivers in the middle of the United States that still, you know, have the, I think, the political will where they go, you know what, this is not what we signed up to. And they're not in the same strings, if you want to say, the coasts are, because the coasts have lots of commerce flowing through them, and there's a lot of federal money that's attached to it. Not that there's not federal money coming into every group, but I think that we'll find the purity towards the Constitution and the purity in the perceptions of the Constitution are in the Wyomings, Dakotas, and so forth. And so I would like to get your thoughts on, because you've read my Republic Review probably in detail, and you're probably very intimate with the citations that I point to. And as a matter of fact, to go back, if I just real quick, you made comment that they didn't have policing powers. And actually, during the Kentucky Resolution, Jefferson poked them in the eye on this. The only thing you have criminal power and jurisdiction over is treason. Nothing else. And so now you're trying to create the Sedition Act and giving yourself some power over this. And I guess my point is the Constitution was never amended to giving them the Justice Department, the FBI, the Department of Homeland Security, all of these over, BLM, ATF. Well, actually, one would argue that there is merit in having something like the ATF and in collecting taxes, because the government does have the ability to collect tax, but some of their scope is creeped out of that. So, understanding that I'm probably coming close to my 10 minutes and having that, urgency in trying to get this out. When we come back from the break, I was hoping to get some of your insights on what you've read out of that. And I know that we've probably got a few differences, in the margins and so forth. And actually, we're actually at the end of this show. So this is my third segment. So folks, you'll have to listen next week to hear what Bob's going to say, because Bob's going to talk about what I guess his insights, premonitions, and his gripes and complaints about my writing of the Republic Review, and we'll do that when we come back. If you give me some a little more of your time, Bob, if you wouldn't mind.
I'd be happy.
Okay, folks. Thank you so much.
Folks, we'll be right back. Actually, we'll be back next week, so stay tuned and tune in next week.